Hello everyone and welcome to today's webinar, the top 10 ways to stretch your budget by using more open source software in 2010. My name is Greg Bell, I'm the marketing manager for OpenLogic. This webinar is part of the FOSS Bazaar top 10 webinar series, so I'd like to extend a special welcome to those of you who heard about it through FOSS Bazaar and joined us from there. Our webinar is scheduled to last for about an hour today, and we are recording the presentation, so if you can't stay on for the entire webinar or you want to share it with a colleague, just go to openlogic.com/downloads, and you'll be able to download the recording and the slides within about 24 hours. If you'd like to submit a question at any point during the presentation, just type your question into the chat interface and send it to the chairperson, and we'll either address your question on the fly or save it for the Q&A session at the end of the webinar. Our presenters today are Kim Wines, OpenLogic's Senior Vice President of Marketing, and Rod Cope, CTO and Founder of OpenLogic. Kim is going to get us started before handing things over to Rod. So without further ado, I will pass it to Kim and let us get started.
Thanks, Greg. So I want to just start off today by talking a little bit about what we're going to be covering. I'm going to give you a quick overview of OpenLogic, just the 10,000-foot view, so you'll know who we are and how we come at open source and what our perspective is. I also want to just touch briefly on some open source adoption trends, so what we've been seeing over the last year or two in terms of companies moving towards more open source and how economic pressures seem to be helping drive that. And then we're going to jump into the meat of our presentation. We have really two segments to that. The first is we're going to be talking about how do you, from a process and a political point of view, overcome internal roadblocks to the use of open source. So whether those be legal issues or process issues, how do you get open source into your organization and ensure that you're complying with any legal requirements associated with it. And then for the second half of the presentation, I'm going to turn it over to Rod, and he's going to be talking more on a technical point of view about some of the hot open source technologies that are being used out there, the up-and-comers that you should be considering in your organization if you aren't already. So with that, let me kick it off. I'm just going to start with the brief overview of OpenLogic. And really our goal as a company is to help enterprises safely and successfully use open source software. We work with well over 100 large and medium-sized enterprises to help them do everything from select the right open source, get trained on it, get supported on the open source they're using, govern and manage the open source, and basically A to Z, so kind of a cradle-to-grave management and assistance with your usage of open source. We have four main areas where we provide offerings. The first is in provisioning. We have a trusted library of over 500 open source projects. It's available on olex.openlogic.com at no charge, so you can check that out there. And we provide managed updates to our customers. We do provide support on over 500 open source projects, a series of services, both technical, policy, and governance-oriented services, as well as a governance solution called OLEX Enterprise Edition that helps you manage the use of open source in your organization. So that's a little bit about our background and where we come from. I want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing out there in terms of usage by enterprises of open source. So what you'll see here on this slide is really the four stages that we've identified of open source maturity. From on the left side, the prevent stage. So this is when companies are in the mode of, we don't like open source, we're trying to keep it out. The manage phase, where companies are looking at, we are okay with using it in certain situations, but we want to make sure we're managing that process and we understand what we're using. From there, companies typically move into a promote stage, where they feel comfortable with the use of open source, and they're really trying to proactively use open source more and more throughout their organization. And typically, the main goal there is cost savings, as well as agility and taking advantage of some of the features and functionality of these open source solutions. And then the last is the transform phase. And the transform phase is when you go from just promoting the use of open source to looking at how open source can transform your organization, how you can participate in communities, how you can use some of the lessons from open source to change the way that you run IT and do business. What we found over the past few years is companies several years back were primarily in the prevent stage. They were afraid of open source, or at least the legal and some of the top business people were afraid of it. They were concerned about lawsuits or legal risks. And over the last couple of years, most companies have transitioned out of that. They're no longer trying to prevent the use of open source, but rather in the management phase. So in the management phase, we're trying to have open source policies and rules and guidelines and roll those out so that our organization is following them and put in place the appropriate processes. However, on top of that, we've seen over the last year especially a big move towards the promote phase. And I think the big push there has been with the economic downturn. As that happened last year, a lot of companies lost budgets or had budgets cut, might have lost headcount. They were still trying to deliver solutions and applications to their end users, to their customers. And so they looked at more proactively considering open source in all of those projects. So I expect that to continue next year as more and more companies consider open source at least on an equal footing with closed source solutions, but in many cases even preferentially. So many companies are requiring that teams looking to implement new applications consider open source and use it if it meets their needs. So that's where we are right now in this open source maturity model. I want to underline that with some data from Forrester, which is a research organization. And this was based on a survey that they did in Q4 of last year, so just about a year ago, as we were the downturn had started, we were going into 2009. And it asked companies in 2009, where do they see expanding their use? What do they see expanding within their organization in 2009? And the thing that came to the top of that list was open source software. So companies were predicting that they would be looking at open source more actively, and we've definitely seen that among our customers, that they are actually doing that. So with that, I want to talk a little bit about how, as you go into 2010, you can look at getting more open source into your organization as a way to realize the cost savings that can be associated with open source adoption. And as you look at getting into your organization, there are roadblocks that you probably have encountered or will encounter along the way. And I want to give you some tips on how you can get around and over and through those roadblocks so that it can be a much easier path to adopt open source in your organization. So the five roadblocks are listed here. The first is you don't know which open source to pick. The second is you're concerned, or people in your organization are concerned, about support of open source. The third is the acquisition process. It's very different than maybe what you've been used to with traditional closed source software. The fourth is risks of open source. So there's a lot of FUD out there where people are concerned about lawsuits or other issues. And then the last is license compliance. So using open source means that you do need to comply with open source licenses and helping you understand how you can go about doing that. So let's go ahead and jump into our first roadblock. And the one we're going to be talking about first is not knowing what open source to pick. So if you look at open source repositories out there, probably the largest being SourceForge and Google Code, you will realize quickly that there are hundreds of thousands of open source projects. And some of those are appropriate for the enterprise, and some of them are not. Many are for personal use. Many are more hobby-oriented. And even of the projects that you might consider using in the enterprise, if you peruse through some of those repositories, there are many dead projects. Sometimes there's no community. There's only a single person involved, and that person might have lost interest. In some cases, there's no active development. In some cases, the licenses may be things that would raise concern. They may not actually be OSI-approved open source licenses. There may be legal suits associated with some packages, and there could be security issues. So it's very important to realize that just because there are hundreds of thousands, and I can easily go to SourceForge or Google Code and search for a project, just because I found it doesn't mean I should use it. We'll talk a little bit in a moment about how to decide which ones to use. The second thing to keep in mind is the source of the project is important. Obviously, projects store their source code in many different locations. Many of the larger projects will have their own website or homepage where they provide downloads of their source code and sometimes of the binaries. Some projects will store their source code on a repository like SourceForge or Google Code in addition to that or instead of that. In some cases, people will pick up open source projects that are not even associated with those projects and provide downloads in other locations, or there may be mirror sites that are provided as well. So keep in mind that if you haven't gone to, let's call it, the original source, the project that's produced that code, if you've just downloaded it from any place that you might have found it on the web that really has no certification or vetting process, you may not know for sure that you're actually getting the right code. And then the third part is, even if you vet it and say, this is enterprise ready and I've got the source code from a trusted source, it's hard for companies to figure out which projects are the best for any given use. So we often get calls from our customers that say, I'm looking for an open source project to do XYZ. Can you point me in the right direction of a few that might be at the top of my list that I should consider? So how do we get over this roadblock of not knowing which open source is the right one to pick? So the first thing to do is think about defining a certification and a provisioning process. And certification is really, what are the critical criteria that you want to look at to say that open source is appropriate for potential use in your organization? And so this may not tell you that it's technically appropriate for any given project, but does it meet some base criteria? Is it something that's widely adopted? Is there a community behind it that's doing active development? Is there support available if that's something that you might want? Is that support commercial support or only community support? What's the license behind it, and are there any legal issues? And then, of course, for any project, that the technical criteria that you may have to determine if it's appropriate. The second is, think about where this is coming from. So most enterprises that we work with that put in place an open source policy will define allowable download sources. So typically those will include some type of more vetted source. I'll talk a little bit about our free library called OLEX, as well as project home pages. There may be a specific set of forges that are allowed. Some people will allow broad forges like SourceForge. Others will look at forges like the Apache project homepage or the Eclipse project homepage. Some companies will allow particular Linux distros. So, for example, if they use SLUZ or they use RHEL or they use a particular distro, any packages that are bundled, that is an allowable source for the source code. So that ensures that you're getting it from a source that has some basic vetting. And then also many companies will also create an internal repository where they will put open source that they have vetted to some level, and they'll make that available. So that can be a first source that your developers can go to find the appropriate open source packages. Now, let me talk a little bit about some of the resources that are available. First of all, OpenLogic provides freely available certified library. So these are open source packages that we have put through a 42-point certification process to ensure that they meet basic criteria for enterprise use. So that includes that they meet certain criteria of adoption, they meet criteria around support, around the community, around activity, around their license and legal issues. So this can be a great starting point because it tends to represent the most broadly used open source packages. And so if you find something in our certified library, you can be confident that it's at least met some basic minimum criteria. And then you can obviously add your own technical or other criteria on top of that to decide if it's appropriate for your use. All of this library is available for free on a site called OLEX, olex.openlogic.com, so feel free to check that out. And that site not only provides a library of those certified packages, but it also includes over 130,000 other open source packages and a comprehensive set of search capabilities, so you can search and find the open source that might be appropriate for you. You can get information on the licenses, you can get security alerts associated with them, and the downloads that we provide have been vetted. So we always go to the original source of the project downloads, we vet them and make sure that they are the accurate source code that you would want to use. The other thing that you'll see associated with OLEX is something that's called OLEX WASI, and you'll see a link to that on the OLEX page. And that provides a set of articles, again, freely available for you on open source. And these articles range from everything like comparison topics, so you can see comparisons of open source packages in a particular category. You can see in-depth how-tos. You can get all sorts of information about open source so that you can pick the appropriate open source packages for your particular needs. So that's the first roadblock. Let's move on to the second roadblock, and this is concerns about support. And this particular roadblock typically comes up as either the first or second issue whenever enterprises are surveyed that they are concerned about when using open source. And sometimes for developers, they are familiar with the open source and they feel comfortable using it without anything but the community behind it. But enterprises that are looking to deploy into production, that are looking to use on mission-critical applications, often want to make sure that they at least have an option for SLA commercial support. So let me talk about the three different support models that exist out there for open source. The first is community support. So this is pretty obvious. There are mailing lists and forums that you can go to for each project and ask your questions and hopefully get a response. The responsiveness varies widely. I have seen open source projects where there's no response to any support issues, especially ones that are only backed by a person or a small number of people can fall into that category. But then there are communities that are very active and very responsive to people asking questions. So you can ask a question there. You may get an instant answer. You know, you could get something in a matter of minutes, could take much longer, or you may get no answer at all. So there's no guarantee from those communities that they will give you an answer. The other thing to keep in mind is there are certain norms about how you interact with the community through these forums, and there can be cases on some projects where people may flame newbies who ask questions that they deem inappropriate. One of the biggest sore points for many community members is people who don't look elsewhere on the website or read the documentation first. And then also it's important on those forums that you properly formulate your questions and provide as much detail and information as you can so that you can get help in getting the answers. Obviously, there will be no SLA, so no service level agreements. If you have bugs, those bugs will typically be captured. Usually there's a bug repository where you can even enter the bug yourself. Whether it's fixed or not is a different issue. It will typically get prioritized, and that may be a high or a low priority, and that prioritization process varies by project. If you provide a patch of your own, so for example, if you say, here's a bug, and you attach a patch to it, then there's a higher likelihood that they may evaluate that patch, take it in, and actually include it into the code. The second option for you is vendor support. So vendor support is available on some open source projects, so obviously not on every open source project. At OpenLogic, we provide support on probably the broadest number of open source projects, which is over 500. But you can also find single project vendors, so vendors that are focused around a particular project, and they help to develop it, and they provide support on it as well. So in many of the popular projects, you will have multiple vendors supporting it, so you will have multiple support options. So unlike the traditional closed source world where there's one vendor to go to and you're kind of stuck, you have to go to them or you can't get support, with open source, you have probably choices. So don't be afraid to go out and find several vendors to get competitive bids, or even to ask for tests of trial support incidents. So we often do that for our customers where we'll give them a trial support incident. Sometimes that's done just with us. In some cases, customers will even look at it in a head-to-head model. They'll be looking at two vendors. They'll ask them both to resolve the same support incident and see how the support process works. So your options are going to include a single project vendor, so somebody that focuses on one particular project. You'll also find those most in application-level things, but obviously something like, you know, a JBoss, Red Hat would be backing JBoss. Or you can find open-source support aggregators, so companies that back multiple open-source projects. So we are in that category, and there are other vendors out there in a similar situation. So those are your options to look at as you look at vendors. And then the third option is something that many customers consider, which is do-it-yourself support. So they really use their internal experts at least as their first line, or in some cases as their complete support resource. So let's talk a little bit about which one might be appropriate in which case. I think there's really two considerations. The first is the mission criticalness of your application. So how important is this? How risk averse are you? How much can you afford to have an issue? If you have an issue in the middle of the night, do you need somebody to call to resolve it immediately, or is it something that can wait until somebody responds? And then the second is, what kind of internal expertise do you have? Do you have a lot of internal expertise across a broad set of groups, or do you have kind of a limited set of internal experts? Maybe there's one person or a few people. One thing we find often is that there are people in development that use the open source project in developing an application, and then it gets passed off into production. And then the development team goes on to other projects, or sometimes developers move to different projects. And so they're not really available on a 24/7 or even on an 8/5 basis to provide support. And so in cases like that, the production team may be interested in having that type of SLA support. So if you find something is mission critical to you, then you're probably going to want some kind of vendor support. You may start off, if you have lots of internal expertise, you could start off by using your internal experts as your first line of support, and then you back that up with your vendor. If you have limited internal expertise, you may need to go directly to the vendor on all of your support issues. So look at that. Now, mission critical could mean production mission critical, but there can also be tools and desktop applications that are mission critical. So we see some customers where, for example, Subversion or some particular tool is used so broadly in their development organization that they want to make sure that they have support on that. So keep that in mind when you're determining what is mission critical. The second area is, if it's not mission critical, if you have lots of internal expertise, then probably using internal experts backed up by the community makes sense. So somebody internally can answer the question. If there's something they can't answer, you can go to the community and hopefully get an answer. And that especially will work with more active projects that are more popular. If it's something where there's limited internal expertise, that's when you might want to consider a vendor support option, or you could obviously go with the community support option if you were comfortable with the fact that you might not get an answer and you might be stuck at that point. So these are some of the criteria to look at in determining which is the appropriate support option for your needs. The third roadblock I want to talk about is the acquisition process. And this is interesting because many people working in IT and working in enterprises don't particularly like working with software vendors, people trying to sell them software. But there is a well-defined process that companies understand when they're working with a vendor. You know, often they determine the requirements, they research the vendors involved, they do an RFP or an RFI or an RFP potentially. They then will call the vendors in to get a demo possibly. They might go into a trial mode where they actually try out the software. They might get customer references from the vendor. They would go through negotiation with the selected vendor and go through a legal and contracts process. So these steps are pretty well understood. When you're working with open source may or may not have a vendor associated with it. And in the cases where there is a single vendor focused on it, you may be able to use a very similar type of process. But in many cases, especially with a lot of open source that gets embedded into other applications, as opposed to open source, it's an application in itself, the model is very different. And the default model that the projects kind of expect is you go out there, you find a project that you want, you download it, and you try it, and then you use it. Well, unfortunately, for many large organizations, that model bypasses some important steps that are really critical to successful and safe deployment in your organization. So what you're going to want to do is to look at your process for acquiring software and to tweak and adjust that process so that you can apply it to acquiring open source software. So some of the things that you might include in that process is similar is determining requirements, so just like you would with closed source software. The second, researching projects. So go out there and find maybe a set of projects using sites like OLEX or other Google searches or other forges to find projects that might be appropriate for you. A key step to do pretty early in the process with open source is to evaluate the license. Since many open source projects do have licenses that have some pretty significant restrictions on them, especially if you are planning to distribute the resulting application, you'll want to make sure that that license aligns with how you want to use that software and that your company is okay with using that license. Because there's many cases where a developer picks something that works technically, they get further down the line, legal gets wind of it and finds out that there's a big issue, and now you're stuck ripping something out. So check out that license early on, and then go through your download and try it phase. And then there's probably going to be a formal approval of some sort. So once you've said, yes, this would work for me technically, or this is our preferred solution, you'll want to go through an approval process to make sure you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's in terms of legal and procurement and support and all of those other issues. Part of that process, depending on your company, may be finding support vendors. So if your company requires support vendors for things that go into production, for example, or things that meet certain criteria, you'll need to do a little due diligence to figure out who those vendors might be, and then go out, talk to them, get the appropriate quotes, and then put it through your legal and contracts process. So it's important to give guidelines to developers so that they know upfront what are the do's and don'ts. It's important to involve the key constituents in the process, just like for closed source software. So your technical team, your architecture group, whatever management needs to be involved, your legal team, your procurement team, so that you make sure that you dot these I's and cross these T's and don't get into trouble later on. In terms of approval processes, many companies do create some type of an automated approval process. We do have some tools at OpenLogic that can help you to do that if that's something you're interested in. And then lastly, you may want to consider an audit to ensure compliance. So you may want to have a process by before an application gets deployed internally, or if it's something you're distributing, before it gets distributed externally. At some point in that process, you actually scan and find out what open source has been used and audit to make sure that you follow all the rules, that it meets your policies, that you're complying with the licenses, and that you're okay to go forward. So let's move on to the next roadblock, which is concerns about risks associated with open source. There's really several areas that this falls into, and so this will come from some of the naysayers in your organization. So one is support. We've talked a little bit about this. There's some people who are concerned that it's not high quality, that it's not tested to the same level as commercial closed source. Security, is there security holes or breaches? And then there can often be, from a legal perspective, concerns about IP ownership. So there may be concerns that an open source project used code that belongs to someone else or is patented by somebody else, and it could cause your company problems if we use that. So let me just talk a little bit about how to address some of those concerns about risk. I think on the support side, we've talked a little bit about that, but knowing and communicating that there are support options available if you do need commercial support, and researching support vendors if needed for a particular project and putting a contract in place works really well. With some of our customers, we have a model where they can get support on any of the 500 open source packages in our library. So the nice thing about that is, regardless of where a problem lies in any of those 500 packages, they can call us. And if they want to start using one of those 500 packages, they don't have to sign a new contract. It's just covered under their existing contract. So you can do things like that with aggregated support providers, or you can go out one at a time and purchase support contracts on each open source package you use. The second is quality. The quality of open source, just like with closed source software, can vary, but many projects are same or better quality as traditional closed source alternatives. The key is selecting the right projects, so typically the ones that are more active, more used, have been around for a while, passed the OpenLogic certification process, are going to be the ones that are going to meet those higher levels of quality. There's also a lot of reviews and articles out there and places where you can talk to other users about their experience. Security is a question that gets raised. Some people feel that by being open source, things are less secure because somebody can look at the code and figure out how to circumvent it. However, in reality, what happens is by the code being open, there are more developers that are focused on closing any security holes. It's easier to find them and fix them. And so the general best knowledge of security experts is that open source is, by definition, no less secure than closed source software. There are security vulnerabilities out there, just like for closed source software. There are places that you can look up those security vulnerabilities. We provide that information on the OLEX website. We provide open update emails to our customers. There are public sites like the National Vulnerability Database that you can access as well to look up that information. And then the last issue is IP ownership. People are concerned that maybe there are patents or copyrights that have been violated by the open source projects. while that is possible, that's no different than the issue with closed source alternatives. So there are cases where many closed source companies, traditional software companies, incorporate code from other places, including both open source code or code that they developed or code that they outsourced, and those can violate patents just as easily. A couple ways to address that. The first is kind of using certified open source. That doesn't guarantee that there's no patent involved, but it helps ensure that it's really a certain minimum bar, and so there's a higher trust level associated with it. The second thing that many companies do is they purchase open source indemnification. And indemnification is really a legal protection, kind of an insurance policy that says if you decide to use open source, a particular package, and you get sued over the usage of that because it turns out that the project violated a patent or a copyright, it provides you with financial protection in that situation. So these are things, open source indemnification is something that you can get from vendors. So some of the single product vendors will offer indemnification on their projects. In the case of OpenLogic, we do offer indemnification along with our support offering on 500 projects. You can also go out to insurance companies and buy a particular insurance policy around open source indemnification. All right, last thing, and then I want to turn it over and get on to some technical aspects. The last thing is concerns about license compliance. And this comes mostly into play for people that are distributing software that contains open source in it. So you could be a software company, you could be a company that makes hardware that has software inside of it that you sell to customers. But distribution can also come into play through giving software to customers or giving software to partners. So, for example, if you're a manufacturer and you sell through some kind of a channel and you give out software to your distribution channel and that contains open source within it, this applies to you. If you have free software that you make available to your customers, this applies to you. If you are only using for internal use and it never goes outside the walls of your organization, including to partners or customers, then the risks are lower. There are still some license obligations for open source licenses that do apply, but they are much fewer and they are much less onerous. A couple other things to keep in mind on license compliance. There are more licenses associated with an open source package than you realize. So many people will go out and they'll download an open source package and they'll read on the website or in the repository that that package is licensed under a particular license. So let's say it's licensed under something like Apache or BSD, which are very pretty easy to comply with licenses. And so they think this is okay for me to use. If you start to look at what you've downloaded and look through that code and look at what other packages have been bundled in it, you'll find two things. First of all, the open source package itself may have and probably does have in most cases more than one license involved. It will have the primary license that was stated by the project creators and owners, but it may have included other code from other places that have different licenses associated with it. So it's very important to not just look at the primary licenses, but all of those other licenses. And the second thing is that distribution or that download that you got may include other bundled packages. So, for example, the poster child for this is the Spring framework. This is a common Java framework. When you download that and you unbundle it, you'll find that there are dozens of other packages under dozens of other licenses. You may not be using any of those packages, and you may not need to use them, but if you provide them in an application that you put outside of your organization, you still need to comply with those licenses. So this is the challenge associated with license compliance. Distribution is critical in this. We talked about this because it does trigger additional obligations and it makes it more likely you'll get caught if you violate a license. And distribution may be broader than you realize, and I've listed a few of these things here that you need to consider. But anything that goes outside of your organization constitutes distribution. So the tip is look at what you're distributing, and anything that you're distributing needs to have a very close look in terms of licenses and compliance. And when you go to do compliance, there's a few best practices. First of all, put together a manifest, get information from the developers, both internal, any third-party outsourcers that worked on it, about what open source they believe they've used in this code. Look at the claimed license for any of that those packages. So sometimes we've seen on many repositories, if you go to SourceForge, a project will say it's under license X. If you look in the code, it's actually under license Y. And that's because many times licenses change and the developers don't update the information in the SourceForge repository. Or it could be because they filled that information in before they had even assigned a license to the project. The next level is to really scan the software. And there's a bunch of different scanning tools available, both open source and commercial tools. We at OpenLogic have some as well, both open source and commercial tools. And you can use that to find any open source that's used. And that's because typically the stated usage by the developers is not completely accurate, just because it's hard for them to keep track of. You'll want to compare that the licenses use the standard license text. You'll want to then review all the licenses for obligations, look for lawsuits, determine whether you've modified the code or created a derivative work, and create a compliance checklist for your developers so that they'll know what they need to do in order to comply with the open source licenses. So that's really the fifth roadblock. With that, I want to turn over to Rod to talk about hot open source technologies you should consider. So let's transition over to a technical talk and talk about some things that you might want to look at once you have all these great processes and policies in place.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kim. So we'll look at five different areas here. One is what I call the usual suspects. So these are the open source tools that you're probably already using, but you may not know that they're quite ready for full production rollout throughout the enterprise, and let's talk about some of the reasons why we think there's a handful that are ready. We'll also talk about Linux. There's not just one. There are other community open source versions of Linux distributions other than Red Hat that are ready for prime time. We'll also look at elephants in the data center, and by elephants we mean Hadoop in cloud computing. We'll also talk about entering the matrix with virtualization technologies, and finally wrap it up with scripting. It's not just for script kiddies anymore. All right, so moving on to the usual suspects. These are the ones you're probably already very familiar with: Apache Web Server, Tomcat, the servlet engine, JBoss application server, and MySQL database. You're probably already deploying them around the edges, maybe in the enterprise and department-level apps or non-mission-critical areas. What you may not realize, though, is that in the last 12 to 18 months, a lot of enterprises have passed the kicking-the-tire stage and moved into full production rollout. We find that developers like these tools because they're stable, they're well-documented, there's lots of tutorials, good community support, forums and wikis and blogs and whatnot. So it's easy to get started. It's easy to deal with challenging situations that enterprises might face. And these tools also comply with industry standards. And many times they actually push the standards ahead or create new standards. But in any case, they almost always adopt them quickly, which means you can swap them out if you do run into issues and move back and forth among open source alternatives, or even switch back to commercial if you decide to go that route. Architects find that because they're widely deployed, there are many other peers that have gone through similar situations, maybe face the same challenges and problems, and gotten them resolved. So there's a wealth of knowledge out on the internet. They're also very easy to support. You can go to the point solution providers like Sun and now Oracle for MySQL support, or Red Hat for JBoss support, or you can go to vendors like OpenLogic that provide that aggregated level support across many projects. But in any case, you do have a number of choices. CIOs have found that these tools are enterprise ready, and you can replace them, replace your current WebSpheres and WebLogic and even Oracle databases in more and more situations. It used to be really only considered suitable for fringe deployments, and now just at OpenLogic, we have global 2,000 customers that have deployed each of those four, Apache, Tomcat, JBoss, and MySQL, into thousands of machines and instances in their enterprise, and we provide that 24/7 SLA support on them. So the tide has come with these tools that are ready for full enterprise deployment. So some tips are, because they're ready and they're high quality and proven and scalable, and you can get commercial support from a number of sources, including the active communities, it's really time to add some of them to your standards list. We've seen some of our customers change their stance from a maybe consider open source these open source alternatives only when there's not a good commercial tool available, to put them on par. And now finally we're seeing recommendations where the open source is now the required evaluation bucket, meaning you have to consider them when you're going to deploy a new solution. You can't just go with your favorite commercial tool because that's what you've done in the past. So you can save money with these tools. They are ready for prime time. So think about making them part of your standards. So you can look at them for major new projects or migrations. We've also seen customers look at pretty significant rollouts. We're talking about 1,000 servers plus at a time, going from commercial to some of these open source solutions. So shifting gears a little bit to Linux, there is not just one Linux. As we know, there's 150 or so distributions, but a couple stand out. And in particular, CentOS stands for Community Enterprise Operating System, is an enterprise Linux distribution, and it's made from the publicly available sources of Red Hat Enterprise Linux, where they've basically just taken out the logos and trademarks. So it's the same code under the covers. It works exactly the same way. It will support all the hardware it supports today, etc. It's binary compatible, but it just doesn't have the logos and icons, and it doesn't have the Red Hat support behind it. What you do get is the major releases are still put out within a month to a month and a half of the official Red Hat Enterprise Linux release, but the patches are available very quickly, and so the goal is within 72 hours, and frequently that's 24 hours that the patches are out. So you don't get the Red Hat Enterprise support. You can go to other vendors, and for example, OpenLogic offers support on CentOS, and our Open Update service will notify you of critical security patches and bug fixes and updates. So you've got something that's analogous to the Red Hat network there. So benefits to developers are, it's familiar. You're already using Red Hat Linux in your production environment. You've got essentially exactly the same software here. If your current software runs on RHEL, then you can run the same software on CentOS. Architects find that goal of 100% binary compatibility with RHEL to be important, because it means you don't have to spend a lot of time revalidating your solutions or doing any kind of excessive testing to make sure that it still works on this flavor of the OS, as opposed to maybe going with a very different distribution of Linux like an Ubuntu or something, where you would have to spend a lot more time checking compatibility. CIOs like the solution because there's a lot of cost savings over RHEL. You've got the same software, meaning you'll get the same compatibility with what you're using today. You can get service from other vendors like OpenLogic, but it's a lot cheaper than going to Red Hat. So some of the tips around this are to start evaluating things like CentOS and other community operating systems. CentOS primarily for servers, that's really the focus, where you might want to look at something like Ubuntu or Debian or some of the other distributions if you're looking at desktop deployment. But today, I think you'll find that on the server side is really where the core strength is here. A lot more testing, a lot more usage there, and that compatibility has been put through its paces and proven out. So places to start, look at department-level apps, non-mission-critical environments, not ultra-high-performance situations. And the primary reasons for these recommendations are it's going to reduce your risk and your stress all around if you start with something a little less mission-critical. Gain some experience, prove that it works, get your relationship with your support vendors underway, established and tested, and then expand as appropriate. And make sure you evaluate the commercial support options just like you would if you went to RHEL or some other commercial Linux distribution. Okay, moving on to elephants in a data center. So cloud computing is a big theme today. How do we take advantage of that? What is it? Is there some open source that can help me with that? Well, in fact, there is. One of the leading solutions, in fact, or capabilities is being provided from the open source community in the form of Hadoop and the ecosystem around it, like HBase and Cascading and Pig and Hive. And there's a number of projects in that community, and they're all driven from an initial contribution from Yahoo around big data, where Yahoo decided that they needed to have a way to harness in a horizontal fashion a bunch of commodity servers. So these are your standard rack-based servers in your data center, not highly redundant, not extremely expensive, but more commodity equipment that's built knowing that there will be failures. It's not going to be up 100% of the time. And yet you want to get massive scalability and you don't want downtime. How can you do that? Well, Hadoop gives you a cloud infrastructure where you get scalability on commodity hardware, where you can tolerate boxes going down and being added to the system in a non-homogeneous environment, where you can have different CPUs, different numbers and types and sizes of disks, and you don't really have to care about those details. The Hadoop system will take care of that for you. This has been rolled out not just at Yahoo, where they've scaled it to thousands of machines, and in fact the target goal for the design is 10,000 machines in a single cluster. It's also in heavy use at Amazon and Facebook and Visa, and the list goes on. And so what kind of problems are you solving with this? Well, generally they're called big data problems. And by big data, we're talking about terabytes and petabytes of data, where things like MapReduce, if you've heard of that technology, is a way to easily scale your problem and parallelize it, if you have a problem that's in the general ballpark, of course, and parallelize it across these thousands of machines and get linear scalability. Also closely related is the NoSQL movement. And what that's about is developers saying, you know what, just because I've got a bunch of data doesn't mean I have to put it in a relational database. I may have a need where I just need a giant hash table. I want to put data in and get data out, and maybe I need some versioning control and some timestamps and some basic concurrency control, but I don't need lots of complex joins. I'm not running report-centric SQL where I've got lots of nested subqueries and that sort of thing. I just need access to a big chunk of data, and I need it fast, and it has to be very large, in fact, so large that it won't really work in traditional relational databases today. So in that case, developers find that these big data solutions like Hadoop and Friends make it a lot easier. I don't have to mess with SQL. I can just get my data in and out, and it will scale, and it will scale limitlessly based on how much hardware I can afford. So architects really like the ability and the freedom they get here, because they don't have to worry about sharding relational databases, turning off indices, scaling issues, replication issues, and those nightmares, where essentially what I wind up doing is stripping a relational database of all the relational features that matter to me, like the ACID and concurrency control and all those extra features that tend to break at the scale we're talking about with big data. So if you have one of those situations, Hadoop and Friends can really help out. CIOs can save millions by not paying Oracle in particular the seven figures in order to buy the types of solutions that scale up to, you know, the gigabyte type range. Even Oracle would choke under these kind of loads where you're talking about petabytes. For example, HBase, which runs on top of Hadoop, the design goal, what it was built for, is to handle billions of rows with millions of columns each, where the columns can hold megabytes per column. So we're talking about very, very large data here. At the bottom there, you'll see Gartner has said that cloud and advanced analytics are number one and number two technologies to look at in 2010. I think those go together really well when you look at something like Hadoop that lets you not only hold that much data, but then through related open source projects like Pig and Hive and Mahout and others, run business intelligence algorithms on that bulk of data to look for trends. So, for example, you could process giant log data from your websites or credit card transactions or customer information look at trends, do predictive type analytics on a scale that was just unprecedented. So some of the tips around this area are get educated and experiment. What are these things? How do they work? Can I use some of it in my business? Does this allow me to do something new that I couldn't do in the past with relational databases? Public clouds are a great place to experiment. So Amazon, for example, with their EC2 Elastic Compute Cloud allows you to quickly turn on a Hadoop cluster, play with it, and shut it down. So pay for just what you use. So try it for new applications. Address temporary demand spikes if you've got a big testing challenge coming up, or maybe end of quarter type situations where you need to do a lot of number crunching and you don't need it again. You can find ways to leverage your existing data center hardware and get rid of that downtime. So instead of having idle computing cycles, put in a private cloud infrastructure and see what you can do with it. Okay, moving on to virtualization. You may already be using a lot of virtualization from VMware, maybe Microsoft, but you may not be aware that Xen, bought by Citrix, and supported by Citrix, KVM, backed by Red Hat, and VirtualBox, technology out of Sun, is also widely used. For example, Amazon in their EC2 uses Xen on thousands of machines. Linux distributions are bundling in these open source hypervisors, these virtualization technologies, so you may already have them in your OS. And in fact, Gartner is saying we're looking at a 10x jump in VM usage from today to 2012, up to 58 million. So a lot of benefits, especially I find in the testing environment. So we use it a lot in our own QA at OpenLogic because it's easy to turn up an environment, test it, and then bring it down. You can snapshot it, start with a clean slate the next time you do testing, and so you don't have to worry about any configuration being messed up or you're dragging along any baggage that's going to break something later. Architects find there's less hardware to buy and therefore maintain in the future. And in CIOs, I just saw an article in Computer World from last month where one CIO reported they save $100,000 a year by converting just 500 machines in power and cooling costs alone. So there's a lot of money to be saved here. Some of the recommendations, I found that the open source hypervisors themselves are on par with the commercial closed source equivalents. Where you're going to find the biggest gap is around the enterprise type management tools, you know, big migrations, large scale management. So if you want to use some of these open source tools today, look at testing, look at experimenting, so trying out new technologies quickly and then shutting down your VM and moving on to something else if it doesn't work out, or other non-mission critical type production apps. And finally, last technology we'll look at is scripting, not just for script kiddies anymore. You know, scripting languages have had kind of a bad rap in the past of, well, that's what hackers use, or that's for college students, it's not for enterprise work. Well, what we found in the last couple of years is that's really shifting, especially with languages like Groovy that are 100% Java compatible, work with all the Java VMs. You can share code back and forth with Java. Even tools like JRuby, which is a bridge between Java and Ruby, also let you do that and share your existing Java code and framework, but use new technologies that are available through the scripting languages. And then the kind of old standbys of Python and Perl and PHP and others. We found that productivity is much higher with these tools. At OpenLogic, we actually switched from Java to Groovy and Ruby and Rails in the last few years. And we found that productivity has gone up. Developers have more fun, so morale is higher, which means architects can find that they beat their deadlines. They can react faster to change. You don't have so much ceremony, as it's called in the code, where you're dealing with overhead of syntax and lots of XML configuration files and heavy commercial applications that go along with them. You can be more lean and agile, get the job done. CIOs can show results while saving money. And as a couple examples, you see Twitter is based on Ruby and Rails. LinkedIn, Groovy and Rails, Facebook, PHP, Google is primarily a Python shop. So these are very, very high-scale environments based on the size of data, the number of hits per second, et cetera, and these scripting languages are holding their own and, in fact, are the preferred solution from some of these new web companies. And enterprises are starting to catch on that you know, we can do some of this too. So some of the tips, learn a new language. You know, Java and C-sharp are not the only languages you can use in an enterprise environment. In particular, the modern scripting languages really excel at web-type applications. Our OLEX is built on Ruby and Rails, for example. It is a lot faster to get things done, a lot less headaches, and it's also easier to change. So it's complementary to agile development processes. You don't have to spend months getting up to speed. You can be very productive in days in some cases. So look at these languages and see if any of those fit your technology toolbox, not to replace your primary language, but to be another option and then grow with it over time. So try it on a test project, evaluate your own productivity gains, and see if you become more agile, see if it's worth it for you. So to wrap up the technology side, the usual suspects, you're probably already using them. See if you can get bigger wins. Maybe start migrating them closer to the core of the business and not so much just on the fringes. CentOS, as a Linux alternative to RHEL, it's basically the same as what you're using today, but it's cheaper. So it's an easy thing to test out. Hadoop, HBase, and friends, I'd say broaden your horizons. Are there things you can do with this that you just couldn't do in the past because there's too much data, it was too hard to scale across machines, and you just couldn't process that? So give it a try. It's worked well for us. On virtualization, I'd say it's pretty easy to start with testing. It's also a cheaper way to go on deployment if you start at the fringes. And then finally, scripting, see if you can be more agile. Don't feel like your primary systems development language is the only enterprise-ready language. There's a lot of alternatives now. And to say that we're not just giving you this advice without taking it, I can say that we're using at OpenLogic in a couple of our platforms, Apache, Tomcat, MySQL, CentOS, Hadoop, HBase, Ruby and Rails, virtualization techniques. So we take advantage of all these things and find it's really helped us get more done quicker and cheaper. So I think I'll turn it back over to Kim for the final wrap-up.
Thanks, Rod. I think what we're going to do is try to answer a few questions. I'll leave the summary slide up here. You can kind of read it yourself to recap what we talked about. So we had a couple questions related to certification. So I talked about certified software, and people were asking, what do I mean by that, and are there any industry standards for certification? So there are not any industry standards. OpenLogic has defined their own certification process, which we document in a white paper that's available on our website about the certification process. And then we make available the results of what packages we've already certified on our website at olex.openlogic.com. So you can use that as a starting point. I would recommend it, given that it's free. You know that somebody's at least gone through it and looked at it to make sure it meets certain criteria. And then you're going to probably need to add to that with your own specific issues that are specific to your company. So that's how you can go about looking at certified software. The second question that I wanted to respond to says as follows. It says, when you mention that the risks are lower for software that never leaves your company, does this apply to corporate websites as well? So this creates the question of, if you take software and you put it on your, that contains open source, and you put it on your corporate website, which is external facing, does that constitute distribution? So I'll start off by saying I'm not a lawyer, and I'll also start off by saying that there's not really a lot of case law around this. But the general consensus seems to be that putting something on your website for people to access does not constitute distribution. And the good news about that is, meaning it doesn't trigger all of the more complicated and possibly onerous obligations of open source licenses like the GPL. Now, I will mention a couple of caveats to that. First of all, if there is code that is downloaded from your website, so if there's a front-end client or Java Web Start or something like that that's going to get downloaded to the machine of a viewer, that could be considered construed as distribution, and you may need to comply for that code with the appropriate distribution clauses of the open source licenses. The second is that there is a particular license called the AGPL or the AFARO GPL.
And that license specifically has restrictions for things that are provided in a networked environment, such as on your website. And essentially, it means that all of the GPL clauses that normally apply when you distribute would apply when you provide it in that networked environment. So if anything that you are using is based on that AGPL type of license, you will need to pay attention to those requirements and those restrictions. I think I had one more question that I wanted to get to, and this was about somebody asking, is there a license cost for deploying MySQL in a production environment? So let me answer this a little bit generally and then specifically on MySQL. So in general, if you have an open source license, those licenses give you the ability to use the software pretty freely, and obviously the details vary based on the specific license. In some cases, so you could deploy those into production without there being a cost associated with it. In some cases of open source projects, there are vendors that have two versions of the open source project. One that's truly an open source version under an open source license, and MySQL is one of those. So MySQL is available under the GPL license. And then they will have a second version that's available under a commercial license and for which they will charge a subscription type of fee. So the way that MySQL works is it is available under what we call that dual license. There's a GPL license. You don't need to pay for that. You can just download it and use it. But you must comply with the terms of the GPL. If you are distributing MySQL as part of another application and therefore you find it's not in your company's interest to use a GPL version of the software, you can go to MySQL, which is now part of Sun and soon potentially to be part of Oracle, and you can purchase a subscription under a commercial license that would allow that distribution without requiring you to comply with the GPL license. So if you are solely using it internally and there is not a distribution issue, then it's likely that using that free GPL version will be just fine. Now, there's a second factor to this, which is the support angle. So if you want commercial support, then you have several options for vendors that you can purchase that from. You can go to MySQL itself. They do sell, as part of their subscription, a support offering. OpenLogic also sell support on MySQL, and there are probably other vendors out there as well that you can consider for getting support. So with that, I think we've just gone over our time by a few minutes, so I think we'll wrap that up. If there are any other questions that we didn't get to on the call, we'll follow up with you via email. And we will put up our contact information, both for myself and for Rod, as well as the URLs for OpenLogic's website and the OLEX website that I mentioned, so that you can access some of those resources that are available there. We also do have several Twitter feeds, if you're interested in keeping up to date on what's going on with open source. Thank you, and we'll talk to you sometime soon, hopefully.
Thank you. Please stand by.